the amplifiers now are really quite extraordinary by comparison to what they were. I can actually show frequency response curves, which it sounds awfully techno-geeky, but it's actually how you judge an amplifier. In the original old days, and I'm older than some of the old days in this field, let me do a screen share here. This is actually two amplifier response curves. The QSI amplifier in Canada was miscalibrated, and this curve was to show the miscalibration. You had to divide the QSI values by two because they miscalibrated their amp. And they compared it to the Massachusetts amp that was being used by Bob Thatcher in his database. And you can see the response curve below one. This goes from low frequencies to higher frequencies up near 40. And this is essentially the percentage of the original signal, which should stay at 100% at the one line here. Well, you can see at about 1 hertz or so, it drops off precipitously. And it's difficult to have a DC amplifier back in the late 60s, early 70s when this amp was current. But it generally follows close. There's about a 12% overestimation in the low 20s of the beta frequencies. And then it drops off precipitously at about 25, 26 hertz. At 40 hertz, 90% of the signal's gone. So you really can't see gamma. So the Roy John, who used the same amp, stopped his database at 25, and Bob Thatcher stopped his database at 30 because the amplifier couldn't show anything faster. Now, a modern amplifier isn't as unstable as this. They actually can go down very close to being DC all the way to zero. They don't have the overinflation issue, and they roll off much faster. A medical amplifier should go from somewhere below 1 hertz, usually somewhere below half a hertz, up to 70, not up to 30, but 70. So this is not a medical-grade amplifier that you could use in a hospital for medical EEG. This is an old amplifier that was as good as it was back then. But it's like a 1950s Chevy. It's a great old car for putting around, but unless you're a mechanic with a good budget, don't drive across country with it because you're going to have breakdowns. It was a good car in its era, but there's a lot of regular cars now that are better than that as far as the reliability and the quality of the engineering. If we compare that, this is the Mizar amplifier. This is a log curve. So this is 0 to 1, 1 to 10, 10 to 100. So it's not the same rolling off at 20 hertz. This is 10, 20, 30. It'd basically have dropped off fairly quickly here, not gone out to 70, which is a medical-grade amplifier. And the amps are relatively linear through the pass band. They don't overinflate and then underinflate. They're fairly accurate in their estimation. And there's actually three amplifiers listed here, 201. And I actually have one of the old 201s. It's got Russian writing on the front panel. I don't think anybody else in the US actually has one of these. It was an older style that had a single amp chip that they multiplexed through. So if you remontage, there was a certain amount of error. Everybody calls their 201M the 201. So the blue curve doesn't exist anywhere unless you have an antique device like I might have. And you can see it rolls off. At about a half a hertz, it rolls off. The others are good down to about a tenth of a hertz before they roll off some. And all of them go up to 70. The 202 goes up to about 150 hertz before it rolls off. So, amplifiers are well designed now. And if you take a modern amplifier with a linear response and you force fit it to the database that has an old amplifier that's built upon, you have to warp this linear amp down to a curvilinear distorted frequency spectra to match the database. And if you have a database that was built on that amp, you have to match it. So you have to destroy a linear curve to match your database. Databases that were collected on modern amplifiers don't have to warp something down to them. They basically have a nice linear response. And most modern amplifiers are transposable. Different sampling rates obviously have to be corrected for the subtle differences at the low frequency and high frequency end generally have to be looked at. But the modern amps are awfully stable by comparison. The good old days were good old days, they're the bad old days.
But Jay, it's not always just about the amplifier, it's also about the software.
Yes.
And I tried a couple of software, and even though the meets are, like, for example, amplifier is really good, and the database also, like the for example, the near feedback software that they provide with is let's say very limited in what you can set up in terms of training, and for me and from my experience, it's really important also.
Yes, there's a difference between assessment and training. And assessment, the quality of the amplifier is much more critical. For training, the training software is absolutely crucial. If you're using an amplifier to do infra-low frequency training or infra-slow training, you're interested in content down here in the very low frequencies. Content up at the fast frequencies are not terribly relevant for you. But activity below 1 hertz is obviously crucial. And how you feed it back is crucial as well. So different feedback groups end up having to be very careful, not only what amp, but what kind of electrodes. If you're doing slow cortical potential or infra-low, infra-slow training, and you're not using a silver chloride or a DC resistant electrode. Silver chloride is the classic, but there's carbon fiber and there's silicon electrodes that are also DC stable. But they're rare. They're mostly research labs use those. But the silver chloride electrodes are able to be used, and then you can actually look at the low frequencies without the measurement itself negatively influencing the measurement. If you have a regular electrode, DC current can flow along the wire. And if you have silver chloride, you're sensing the field outside of the wire, but it doesn't allow current to flow into the wire in the same way. So you're not loading down the signal that you're measuring. So you can measure it accurately. The normal baseline drift in an EEG is somewhat eliminated. If there's movement, it's not eliminated, but just baseline drift of the electrode itself, which is present in regular electrodes with polarization potentials, it's just not present in silver chloride electrodes. So electrode systems are critical, not just the amp. Software that you're feeding it back with are critical, not just the amp. But it's astounding that the changes in the amps over time. I can show you dry sensor technologies that have fabulous amplifier responses, but the difficulty with them is the skin contact. You know, if you have a jitter on the skin contact, the amp might be linear, but your signal is terrible. So you have to have more than just the technical detail of the amp, but the amp itself is the base that everything else has to be built upon. And so it's getting the amp right is critical. What I would suggest for most people is that you look around in a clinical meeting and find the people that you want to affiliate with and see what they're using, because you're going to end up being dependent upon those around you for support and mentoring and sometimes formal supervision. Mentoring isn't quite the same as supervision. Supervision's got some very specific legal implications, but you're going to need people to end up supporting your work, and they're going to know the equipment they're working with, and they may not really know the depth of another brand of equipment. So look around for the people you want to work with, and the amps that they're working with are what you're going to end up needing to know. But find the clinicians or trainers. I mean, not everybody's a clinician. There's athletic trainers that use neurofeedback. There's meditation people that use neurofeedback. Find the group that you fit in with and want to learn with and grow with, and you know, pick up what they're working with and see if that's what you feel comfortable with. But you have to affiliate yourself with like-minded people with a similar goal in order to really prosper within the field.
Yes. So I can tell from my experience. So I started with Brainmaster because I worked with Ron, and this is what he used for years. And at the time, I had an impression that I didn't find a lot of work on this in terms of research, but they really encouraged maybe to use Z-score. And I tried a couple of times and it worked really well, but I felt that there's something is missing for me. Besides the classical like protocols that we used to do like SMR and alpha up training, et cetera. And then what happened is that at a certain point, I encounter Seaborn work,
yeah,
which I found to be easier to implement in a clinical setting, like in psychiatry, because you had the very simple, you know, kind of like three possible protocols that you need to adjust in terms of regulation. So I could train people that are not very knowledgeable with EEG and electrophysiology and physiology, how to actually downregulate or upregulate or stabilize arousal. There were some part of the language is something that could be easily work with a lot of the psychotherapy languages. So this is one of the things I used in the hospital, which I really liked. And then slowly I actually discovered more your phenotypes, which I haven't tried yet on patients, but it definitely helped me to better understand some of the symptoms. So for me, there is, as you hear, there was a whole discovery of different domains and groups. And now it's the moment of, as you said, to whom I affiliate myself with and followingly what I buy, you know, in terms of devices. So it's interesting that you didn't give any names or brands or whatever. You generally said, you know, most amplifiers are good, et cetera. So I wonder, I don't know, probably Pete will going to edit it. But I'm just saying, like, why, like, you're not, do you have favorites? Do you have something you find more reliable? Could you share this, or it's something uncomfortable?
You know, the ones that are not able to work well, I basically don't work with. And you know, it's not like I'm not able to call out which ones are not working well. It's just that they've faded away to the point where if I mention their name, they actually have more interest in them than if I don't. And they're faded away almost to non-existence. Why should I mention their name and give them more energy? You know, there are amplifiers that were built by people that have big names in the field, and they built a bad amp, but the amp has basically gone away. So I don't want to disparage the major figures in the field when their amplifier that didn't work went away. If it was still being sold, I would be telling people that you should avoid it. But the amplifiers are basically virtually non-existent now. And
Let me help you out, Jay. Mind Media, Steve Stern, anything I've gotten from them.
Steve Stern's retired, and Mind Media is basically Nexus amplifiers. And pardon me, Nexus amplifiers were an extraordinarily high quality amp when they were initially built. Others have come up to the same general quality at this point. But they had an actively shielded electrode, so DC fields, static fields moving near the patient weren't influencing the recording. If you go back to some of the very early amplifiers, you could shuffle your feet on the carpet 20 feet away from the client and make the signal go crazy. So the Mind Media had the Nexus amplifier, which is actually an EMG amplifier chip that went from DC to 800 hertz. And 800 hertz, nobody in EEG goes there, you know. But if your amplifier overperforms, it's okay, you know. you don't have to go up to 800. It gives you that if you want. But it was a linear amplifier chip that was applied to EEG quite well. Software to operate it, maintenance, things like that end up being the difference at that point. The amplifier quality is quite solid.
What would you buy? Let's say tomorrow you want to set up a clinic. Give me something. would you buy? For example,
if it was for analysis purposes, first of all, I'm going to want an amplifier that has an FDA 510K as an EEG amplifier, and that's a diagnostic medical amplifier.
Which one? You were caught. I didn't.
Well, there's amplifiers that are there that are approved as a general health and wellness or a neurofeedback amp that don't necessarily have themselves qualified as a diagnostic amplifier. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use the amplifier in a diagnostic way, you should have one that qualifies. So you need to be aware that that there are amps that are registered with the FDA as a neurofeedback amplifier that aren't intended for diagnostic purposes. You pay close attention to what the filing with the FDA was. And that's easy to do. You can punch in FDA and the name of the company that you're interested in, and all of the FDA rules and regs and everything about them all pop up online. You can see quickly whether they're registered as a diagnostic EEG amplifier or if they're registered as a neurofeedback amplifier. That changes a lot. If I have the intention of doing a diagnostic workup on somebody and I've got an amplifier that's a general wellness amplifier, NeuroOptimal is a general wellness amplifier. It's a fabulously good amp. It does a nice job amplifying the EEG. It's linear and all of that. But if I make a diagnostic impression based on it, and it goes into a med legal circumstance, and the other side says, well, you're using a general health wellness amplifier and you're making a diagnostic impression, you're not using a diagnostic amplifier. So there's reasons to be careful when you're in my position of actually historically having written medical reports. So there are devices that are perfectly appropriate for the kind of thing they're intended for, general health and wellness. But if you claim to treat something with that, then you're actually outside of the FDA approval for the device. If you're going to treat something, you actually have to have a biofeedback device or a neurofeedback device that's approved for that, not just general health and wellness. And if you're making work with somebody on a more medical circumstance, you may want to have an actual medical amplifier, diagnostically appropriate amp. So there's those three levels of amplifier. Is it a medical device amplifier for clinical EEG? Is it look up the MITSAR and their database, and you'll find that they're listed as a diagnostic device. Look up other software and hardware devices within the field, and you'll find that they're listed as non-diagnostic. What's the difference? Well, the MITSAR is oriented towards the medical EEG, and the QEG is an extension of that medical EEG. So it's a diagnostic device. Mm-hmm. If the software and amplifier are intended to acquire the signal and then process it as a cue without the EEG being the diagnostic, piece of that, then it's not a diagnostic device. It's a neurofeedback device, but it's not intended for diagnosis. Again, there's three levels of FDA, medical EEG amplifier, a neurofeedback amplifier, and a general health and wellness amplifier. There's a three separate classifications. Now, not every other country is going to have those same differentiations. Ultimately, they're a little bit arbitrary. The device that's intended for neurofeedback could just as easily be a diagnostic device. It's just a matter of what they file for. But the FDA filing ends up changing what it looks like if I have to go to court with it. So, and having been in traditional, medical interpretation, court's just a half a step away half the time. So, and somehow I made it through 50 years with no litigation.
Hi, this is Karen. I'm a neuroscientist and neurotherapist from Tel Aviv, and you're listening to the NeuroNoodle podcast.
Welcome to NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology podcast, featuring a neuropsychologist Dr. Laura Janssens, tech whiz, neurofeedback legend Jay Gunkelman, and author of Neurofeedback and the Treatment of Developmental Trauma, Seaburn Fisher. Our goal is to provide information, promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we have a special guest, Karen Aravami. She's a neuroscientist and has some questions for us today. We're going to talk about neurofeedback devices and equipment, but before we get to Karen, we have some Patreon love to dish out. We'd like to thank our Patreon business supporters as well as our show supporter. Mary Tracy's Neurotraining Strategies offers a higher standard of EEG, QEG, education to EEG clinicians, technicians, and neurofeedback practitioners with convenient online BCA and QEG certified didactic courses. Okay, three things our listeners and viewers can do to help spread the word. Please don't fast forward. Please, we need your help. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you like the video, which you will, please hit like and click the bell so it lets you know when our new podcasts come out. That little action can take three people from learning about neurofeedback to 3,000. Please pay it forward. Hey, give us number two. Give us a review on whatever platform you listen to. We'll take 5 stars, but Jay will accept 4.5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And if you have the means, please support us on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. There are different levels in which you can support, whether you're a mom or dad or a clinician. There's even an option where you can have your own Q&A with Jay Gunkelman. Hey, the support helps us improve the quality of our content. Trust me, nobody's driving a Mercedes off of this podcast. Okay, let's talk with our neuroscientist, Karen. Karen, how are you? Welcome to the show. Thank you for showing up. You're a neuroscientist. Please tell us more about you.
Well, what to say, where to start? So I've started with neurofeedback about 8 years ago after I finished my PhD. And I always worked, I mean, since I started to learn about the brain in my master, I always worked in clinical settings, in psychiatry, in neurology, so a lot of applied neuroscience. And I actually started to get to know neurofeedback only about 8 years ago with Dr. Doron Toder, who is today a chief hospital, like psychiatric hospital. And then we used certain devices, certain equipment, certain protocols, I think a lot influenced from how he was supervised by Jay. Following this experience, I was actually offered to set a neurofeedback unit within a psychiatric hospital. And that was a big challenge. I also like to know, you know, which patients to offer this service for how long, because it's not like a private clinic. We cannot do whatever we want because people come and pay, and it's not really paid by the public system. So we needed to find a solution in between solution and to find who can be part of the team, because one person cannot do it by itself. We also had in this research unit, which I was the head of the research, actually a lot of different EEG devices that were used more for research. And they could provide us more like ERPs and EEG, like spectral EEG, all sorts of different analyses. And then we try to combine all this information into the clinical information that was gathered by the clinical team, and to try to figure out how to think about it, you know, in a vast way, because obviously physiology plays a very, very big role in all diseases, and especially in psychiatric disorders. And I think we had, relatively to the fact that we had a lot of limitations, because people, we needed to train people again and again, and then, you know, not all doctors participated or agreed to let a try, you know. I think we had a very good success with very, very, very difficult patients, meaning patients that were in and out of the hospital for years. And following that, I actually started to work in startup companies that develop EEG diagnosis and treatment. And now I'm going back to a hospital, like a general hospital. And therefore I was approaching to ask questions in terms of which devices to buy. And you have to keep in mind that even though, like, we have great connections with the US, I'm not in the US. So for me, not everything is accessible as easily, for many reasons, like also the delivery process, the taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And I already had a couple of, like once that I made a choice and I bought something that ended up to not work well. So this is one of the reasons I actually wanted to talk about how we decide about devices, about diagnosing procedure, database, et cetera.
Now, before Jay gets rolling here, Karen, you're in Tel Aviv, right? Israel? Okay. Jay, it's crazy. More than a third of our viewers aren't from the States. I mean, it's insane. Karen, tell me, what's the adoption like on neurofeedback and EEGs over in Israel? Do you know if it's more or less in the United States, or you don't know, or maybe Jay can pop it? I'm just worried what it's like. I know what it's like here in the Midwest of the United States trying to talk about neurofeedback. I wonder what people think about it over in Israel.
EEG is used only for neurological disorders, mainly epilepsy and maybe brain injury, and sleep labs, of course. But we don't, besides some hospitals, like psychiatric hospitals, just because of research purposes, and then, you know, there's a whole think about how great it is to have like technologies, et cetera, but then it's really hard to integrate them into the clinical practice. So I in the brain unit, in the brain research unit at the hospital, I had about 5 different EEGs, but then to actually ask doctors to send patients and to learn how to use this kind of information, even if I actually was the bridge all the time. I gave the interpretation, I explained what we can do with it. Still, it was really, really hard. So there's something in the education that is really lacking for me.
That's what I'm looking for, because this can't grow unless the schools teach it. People won't use it unless there's somebody's going to pay for it besides themselves. Is there social healthcare in Israel, or what's the healthcare like there?
It's a public medical system. So for really small amount of money, you're pretty much covered. But a lot of these extra things that will move into the insurance level more easily in the US because it's private won't happen here in Israel. Like, for example, TMS. TMS was, even though one of the TMS providers like was actually came from Israel, it was approved only about a year ago, which was not the case in the US because you have private insurance and private medicine. You know, there's positive things and negative things, but even what I want to say that this is, even when everything is accessible and there's someone who's responsible for it and it's for free, it doesn't mean that the doctors will use it. Patients are craving for different types of therapies, you know, and some doctors use it to say, oh, I'm doing something technological, something new, etc. Some doctors really interested in integrating the brain, but most doctors, you know, it's really far away from them.
It's not an easy thing to adopt. You know, the learning curve on EEG and neuroscience in general is one of the steeper learning curves in life. And it may be the right learning curve to be on, but it doesn't make it any easier. Even if there's many people on it, it's still very difficult to ratchet your way up in the level of knowledge. Where do you go to learn about EEG? Well, historically, you have to look over the shoulder of somebody who is looking at an EEG. And there may be online courses now, but it's not as rich an interactive environment as it was when you're one-on-one or maybe a few with one looking at EEGs, which is one of the reasons I'm doing quite a few small groups of just looking at EEG as a way to spend some of my time. But it's difficult to get a new technology, even though this is 50 years old new. It's difficult to get a new technology to active practice. If the schools were teaching it at a high level and we had doctors who were experienced in it in school, they came out into practice, they'd still be a junior practitioner. What they could do would be largely regulated by the senior people within their practice. But, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years later, they could be doing some of the things that they wanted to do. So it takes time to penetrate. I have to say that it's actually more integrated and involved now than it has been historically. But it's hard to see that. In the U.S., people are U.S.-centric, and that's pretty easy to be. In the U.S., people understand New York and California and Texas, but in between is kind of a big wasteland in some people's minds. But the U.S. has areas that have very little, if any, neurofeedback. It's got centers that are well populated with practitioners, but there's a lot of area in the U.S. that doesn't have anybody, and it's going to take a long period of time before it's fully penetrated the market. Our customers don't know who we are. They don't know how to get a hold of us, and they don't know what we do. So it's not an easy market to expand it's a difficult thing to advertise, but it's growing, and it's more proliferated worldwide now than it has been ever before. The level of acceptance in the neuroscience world, the level of publication, the journals that are publishing about it, that are open to publishing about it, this has all dramatically changed. I sometimes joke that the future is so bright now I have to cover one eye. It's an astoundingly active growth that the field is in. Next week, I won't be at the podcast because I have three lectures for a group in Spain. This last week, I had a lecture for a small society in Italy. There's a European society. There's an Australasian society. There's groups all over now. And the level of quality of the equipment in the field has also dramatically improved. Some of the early equipment was just, how can I say it gently? I can't. It was awful. There were devices that just did not work. One of my first trips to Australia, I was preceded a few years before that by somebody who sold them a bunch of equipment that did not work at all. The second day I was there, they were wondering, well, what are you trying to sell? I'm not selling anything. I'm just here to educate. You know, they expected some kind of a sales. But you know, there are very few devices out there now that are awful devices. There were quite a few historically, miscalibrated amplifiers that would fail with a static electrical charge, shuffle your feet on the carpet and touch the patient and the amplifier blows, you know. So we've gotten rid of the really trashy stuff. Most all of the equipment in the field works pretty well. Some of it more quality than others, but if you're in the field, you have a pretty good idea of which group of practitioners you want to work with and the equipment that they're working with. And it's a very bright future with very solid devices at this point, generally available. There are some little backwaters of old devices that are still around, but they're pretty easily identifiable once you're in the field. People kind of warn you away from them if you're listening.
Jay, what are they using in the big hospitals? I mean, I know what we have in our little offices, you know, the amplifiers that back in your day filled up a whole room and fine, was it redwood cabinets that you had? That they were
with the actually, pens? The walnut cabinets were very, very big in the 1970s and early 80s. But you know, the early equipment was really not well considered. They had zero cross detector amps, and they would tell you what the dominant frequency is by counting how many times it crossed the zero point and dividing by two. But if you're a little tiny fast signal riding on top, they couldn't see it. So, you know, SMR, for instance, is usually a very small signal riding on top, not a dominant frequency. So, you know, and that was one of the major equipment lines, Autogen 120, which was it was worth its weight in walnut. And if you opened up the chassis, there was enough room inside of it to carry your lunch, you know. So it was, and there were things on the back panel, plug-in things on the back panel that didn't even have wires hooked to them. So, you know, we've come a long ways from dummied up equipment that didn't work very well. But at this point, it's hard to find something that's not a solid amp. The equipment has had most of the trash washed out of it because of, you know, people identifying it that it's not working very well, and the groups basically end up identifying what works well and not. And the things that don't work well, they might pop up 1 year, but they go away within a year or two.
And FDA, that's a big thing right here in the States. Is in Israel, is yeah, some type of government that, you know.
Internationally, there's different regulatory groups. Europe has its own Israel probably has its own, US, Korea, Australia. But the FDA in the US has been, neurofeedback has been low on their radar. It's not really a big hazard. There's not a lot of customer complaints. Nobody gets electrocuted. Nobody gets surgical problems. I mean, there's the FDA is paying attention to lots of other major equipment and drugs that end up having difficulties. Neurofeedback is usually low on their priority list because it's a very low hazard. It doesn't mean that they don't pay any attention. Neurofeedback is basically approved essentially for relaxation. The one thing it's approved for in the US, relaxation, alpha training. That's it. If you make a claim other than alpha training, you're outside the FDA's approval. And as such, the equipment manufacturers make the equipment, but they can't talk about what it's used for. If they say you can treat ADD with this, or you can treat somebody that has epilepsy with this device, at that point, they're making a diagnostic claim and a treatment claim. And the manufacturer would have the FDA saying, well, you're approved for relaxation training and alpha. You're making a claim outside of that. So either you provide the evidence and go through the 510K approval for that application, or you end up having a claim that you can be fined for substantially. The way around it is that the FDA doesn't regulate clinicians, and they don't regulate educating groups. So a manufacturer will have an affiliated lecturing outfit. BrainMaster has Stress Therapy Solutions, and they're a separate corporation. They do education. They don't sell equipment. The manufacturer lists the equipment and the price and availability, but they don't tell you what it's applicable for, because if they did, they would be in trouble. Now, it's kind of silly in some respects because, you know, the efficacy for ADD is well established. The efficacy for epilepsy is actually well established. There's probable efficacious level support for PTSD and affective regulatory problems and so forth. So the FDA really should be opening up some of the applications for manufacturers to actually talk about. But that's going to require somebody actually going through that process, which is not easy. It's expensive and time consuming. And one small manufacturer in this little teeny tiny niche field really has trouble affording $1 million to go through a regulatory process to get the approval to say it can be used for something, when it's easy enough to just say, talk to them. You know, the educational people are over there. I can't tell you anything. Talk to them. And it saves you $1 million by having a group that other people can talk to. But it still limits the sales and marketing capability of manufacturers.
We integrated the neurofeedback into inpatient acute ward. And we try to do it quickly, you know, not just to wait, but just like quickly see, as I said, we adopted CBERN logic in terms of like downregulating or upregulating or stabilizing. And then we trained a couple of neuropsychologists to use like three simple protocols, and we integrated very quickly into the treatment. And we saw that it led to very, very nice, let's say, relief and also progression, treatment progression in schizophrenia. So we didn't aim, of course, schizophrenia symptoms or whatever. We're just trying to relax the system and like regulate the arousal so it can permit better communication, better compliance, better sleep, better concentration. So being part, for example, in treatment groups, we can attend more, you know, to what's going on and be part of the happening. So we did this really small, short, you know, intervention in order to contribute to the down regulation or up regulation of the system to support the team effort in this treatment course. And I wanted, like, I mean, when you look at the literature, there aren't almost any work on schizophrenia besides one professor from Turkey, from Istanbul, that did a lot of work on, and I met him once in a conference here.
Tanju Sumeli.
Yes, Sumeli. Yeah. And I was wondering, you know, what is your approach? What is your knowledge from seeing a lot of EEGs? If you treated some schizophrenia patients, etc.
You know, schizophrenia doesn't have a single presentation. Yeah. There's been some early work on it quantitatively by Roy Johns' lab at NYU, now under Leslie Pritchup's guidance since Roy's passing. And they basically found some overarousal, lower voltage, faster EEGs and beta spindly EEGs. But one of the more recent studies that I kind of appreciate and ends up being one where they actually look at psychosis, schizophrenic psychosis. They found a third of the people with psychosis have epileptiform content in the EEG. And if you give somebody that has epileptiform EEG content an antipsychotic, it makes them worse. If you don't look at the EEG, and, you know, if you walk into the hospital and you're psychotic, broken with reality, it isn't like they suddenly suspect they should do an EEG always. They'll give you an antipsychotic medication because you're psychotic. But a third of them, it's a mistake. If you don't actually look at the brain function before you decide on your course of treatment, you might have somebody that has something totally different. Inflammatory change in the brain from something. I mean, there's other things. But one third of them will have epileptiform content. You can see easily, and it changes the course of therapy. You use an anticonvulsant instead of an antipsychotic. And the patients turn around very quickly. I had a short bit of work I did with the U.S. military as a no-bid contractor. It took a long time to get the status of a no-bid military contractor, but they could then send us EEGs to look at, and we could give them results without having to go through competitive bidding for every EEG report. And they gave us six clients to see whether we could give them any benefit. And of the first six clients, three of them were temporal lobe epileptics. The odds of that are almost impossible. I mean, I would have bet a lot that we wouldn't get three temporal lobe epileptics if you just drew six clients. But the first one was hearing voices, and he was a Marine. The voices were telling him to kill people. And they weren't his commanding officer. They were inside of his head. You know, these weren't like command voices from outside from a military supervisor. These were voices in his head telling him to kill people. And if you tell somebody that you're hearing voices telling you to kill people, they'll probably give you an antipsychotic. And they did, and it got worse. So eventually they sent the data to us, and we spoke to the attending physician and said, you've got to take this guy off of the antipsychotic drugs. You're telling a psychiatrist that their psychotic patient needs to come off their antipsychotic drugs. This is a big risk. I mean, if I take the patient off these drugs and he does something, there's a gigantic liability. People blame me for whatever he does. We realize the liability, but at the same time, you got a patient and they're being mistreated right now. So really, your liability is a secondary consideration to your client's health. And the doctor put him in the brig, the military prison, basically, in order to take him off of his antipsychotics without having the liability for the psychiatrist, and to put him on anticonvulsants, and the voices went away. So it worked very, very well. This repeated itself two more times out of six people. And as such, we got an open-ended invite to process for them. That went until sequester, which was a cutback on outside contractors for the military. And so we lost half of the business for the company all at once. But we were expanding our business so fast, I was happy to shed the half that we got rid of because we had more people to serve. You can see another group here, mood disorders. Mood disorders, 3%. 3%. That's like the normal background population incidence of randomly finding some discharge of some sort. But if their mood didn't make sense, their mood's going to make sense to them, but if it doesn't make objective sense to somebody outside of them, at that point, a third of them had epileptiform discharges. You could view the mood problems as pseudobulbar affect. Temporal lobe discharges give you out of control emotions. The old term is not appropriate anymore for diagnosing an epilepsy, but it's descriptive, a fit of laughter. Well, the term fit is the trigger. I mean, the person's not having fun laughing. They're not laughing at something that's funny. They're hysterically laughing. And they would just as soon not be laughing. It's out of control, and they realize it quite often. A fit of anger, where they're acting out a rage event. These kind of mood things can end up being epileptiform in nature. So we've got to be aware when somebody is behaving in an unreal way, a psychiatric disturbance of some sort, there's a good chance if one out of three people are going to have epileptiform content, don't you think you should look? Yes. Because it's going to dramatically change their treatment that's appropriate to match them. If they're just full of beta, you can wind them down. If they're under aroused, you can wind them up. But if they have this kind of an instability, you've got to stabilize them. Mm-hmm. Once you stabilize these discharges, if they're stable and they are not discharging, the network that makes them will finally fade away. If you don't use it, you lose it. If you fire together, you wire together. Those are two basic processes within the brain. And every time you make a discharge, it's easier to make that discharge. And it might make a little bit more turf involved as well. It might add in a little piece. But every time you make it not work, it slowly sheds a spoke and a hub in the network that makes it may fade away. You might still have a focus, but it may not have a network. And at that point, you're asymptomatic. So we work very hard on people that have psychiatric presentations to make sure that they don't have epileptiform content. If they have it, we treat that directly. If they have overarousal or underarousal, that's easily dealt with neurofeedback. Neurofeedback teaches you to increase or decrease your arousal level quite readily. It's been one of the applications that have been done since the early days. Lubar used to do CZSMR, FZ-beta. Othmers did C3-beta and C4-SMR, and then they started to reach out in some other areas. But the basics since the late 80s, early 90s have been able to teach control of arousal level. And Sturman's work on SMR and the European work on slow cortical potentials in epilepsy apply directly to these kind of discharges. So we really have the tools to manage these psychiatric disturbances. If we see what they are, we can match the protocol to their presentation. If you don't look, you're making some assumptions. And you know the over-arousal, under-arousal, not that hard to spot usually, but the epileptiform content is awfully hard to predict. And it doesn't always show as convulsions. The psychiatric disturbances of pseudobulbar affect are an example of that. They're not having a convulsion. They're having behavioral manifestations, and not as easy to spot.
Once I had this experience online, I was setting up a patient, and I was sitting during the neurofeedback session with the patient. And at a certain point, I was looking at the EEG screen, and I saw like all this like over-coherent activity happening. And I looked at the patient, and he seems to be kind of disconnected. And I asked him what happened. And then afterward, I reanalyzed the EEG files during the neurofeedback trainings, because the QEG file was too short, and it didn't happen during these 5 minutes that I recorded. So I looked at all these sessions to see if I see any kind of pattern, and we sent him to a neurologist, and we changed the medication consequently, which was very helpful. But that was like, you know, just by accident, because I was sitting there. I was always sitting with patients, but I actually saw something happening online. Yeah. And I could, you know, immediately intervene, and change the course of treatment.
And imagine all the therapy that goes on without the EEG being done in parallel or in the background in some fashion. You know, I'm going to share another piece of information. This is an ADD-ADHD. About a third of the people that have ADD-ADHD have unexpected epileptiform discharges. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but look at this one study, 4%. That's down like the background population. And Martine Arns is a major researcher. I mean, isn't this 4% valid then? The difficulty is that he was using 2-minute EEGs instead of 20-minute EEGs. And these are meeting minimum guidelines of 20 minutes. And if you only do 2-minute EEGs, you have a much lower chance of seeing a transient. There's a medical minimum guideline in the US of 20 to 30 minutes. And 20 minutes is the bare minimum. And 2 minutes just really doesn't cut it. The reason that the 20 to 30 minute standard was set was basically the doctors and techs basically decided, if you do too short a study, you're likely not to see a transient, a rare discharge. And how long do you need to do to get a half a chance of seeing it? 20 minutes gives you a little over 50% chance of seeing a discharge in a known epileptic. So a 2-minute study, inadequate. A 5-minute study is better than two, but it isn't quite there yet. And nobody wants to run 20 minutes sitting there staring at a wall with your eyes open. That's 10 minutes eyes open, 10 minutes eyes closed, or 7 minutes eyes open, 7 minutes eyes closed, and 7 minutes of some kind of a task. But you've got to exceed 20 minutes just to make sure you're not missing the rare discharge. I did an EEG review yesterday. It had one full-blown epileptiform discharge in a 20-minute study, eyes open, eyes closed combined. It was dramatic discharge. In between that, there were some little hints, but there wasn't anything diagnostically significant until the discharge. So the total amount of time recorded ends up being critical as to what you can end up seeing. And I would urge people to try to meet the minimum guidelines. They're there for a reason. If you're doing mini studies, little itty bitty studies to try and assess the client, it's better than not looking, but looking for an adequate amount of time will make sure you're not missing, just because of your procedures being so brief, that you're not missing the client's discharge.
But I believe it gives you a more reliable picture also of like the spectral and not just like the discharges. So it's not just about missing the discharges, but having like, let's say, averages that are like more reliable. Yes. No?
That's correct. The other thing is, in the eyes closed, you know, the Europeans have not just the normative database kind of an approach for analysis. They also have the vigilance model. and the vigilance model requires 10 minutes of eyes closed EEG uninterrupted. You don't cut out pieces and throw them away. They want to see the dynamics of the EEG across time, an ipsative or an iterative analytic process. How does that start? If you're wide awake, you've got alpha in the back of your head, eyes closed. But as you start to get a little less vigilant and attentive, and you can't control your attention quite as well, the alpha goes into the front as well. And that's from A1 to an A2 stage. And then A3, alpha is dominant up front, bigger than the alpha in the back of the head. And at that point, you're not as vigilant as you were when you had alpha just in the back of your head. And you can judge that by how well they respond to tasks that actually judge their vigilance. At that point, alpha drops out. You're starting to actually get into a drowsy state. If you wake somebody, if you alert somebody that's got the alpha having dropped out and say, are you sleeping? No, of course not. Of course they're not sleeping. It's just drowsiness. It's not sleep. People drive their cars that way all the time. I got to exit 20. How did I get here? Last I remember, I was exit 10. Well, you were in highway hypnosis, stage one drowsing. You didn't drive out of your lane. You didn't have an accident. But at the same time, if something happened, you'd have to alert, orient, and response. Your reaction time will be slow. But you didn't drive out of your lane. You're not in stage two sleep, but you're not alert and vigilant. So alpha drops out, then theta starts to happen, then theta becomes prominent. That form of analysis requires a 10-minute steady EEG, not a 2-minute or a 5-minute quick study. In fact, the first 5 minutes are expected to be wide awake, A stages, no B stages. The second 5 minutes, they expect some light B stages, but at no point during the 10 minutes do they expect you to fall into stage two sleep, which they call stage C. And in our EEG recordings, it's very common for us to see people with sleep disorders, and there's more of them now than there used to be. And they have vertex sharp wave of stage two sleep before 5 minutes. And that means they're so sleepy, they have to go to a sleep lab. That they've had a precipitous descent into stage two sleep. They can't stay awake even during the day with their eyes closed for 5 minutes. There's something wrong with their sleep at night. In a sleep lab, they call it a DOES, D-O-E-S, disorder of excessive sleepiness. And if you go in complaining of insomnia, they have trouble getting paid for the testing. But if you can't stay awake during the day, that's their bread and butter. That's where they make their money. And most of the time, it's people like me, older, a little overweight, probably snoring, you know, a little apnea. They'll give you a CPAP device or shrink your soft palate with a laser. There's a lot of treatments for obstructive apnea. But there are other kinds of sleep disorder, too. And a sleep lab will identify precisely what kind. Nobody dies of restless leg syndrome. Apneas can kill you. And my last business partner, Jack Johnstone, passed in his sleep. He had a sleep lab, you know, but he didn't use a CPAP that night and he passed in his sleep. So apneas can kill you, central or obstructive. You don't have to be big and old and overweight to end up having snoring apnea. That's not the only kind. You can be a skinny little kid and have a central apnea and still have great difficulties. Restless leg syndrome, circadian rhythm delay, parasomnias. The little kids have night terrors. You've got to actually do a study. You can't just say, "Oh, you're having trouble sleeping," and ignore the underlying diagnostic evaluation. You have to find the cause and treat the cause. If you're doing neurofeedback and the person has a sleep disorder, you can expect them to have two or three times more sessions than somebody who was sleeping well. During sleep, you long-term potentiate your memory. What I learned today won't be there tomorrow unless I long-term potentiate it. So if I learned XYZ tricks during my neurofeedback session today, I might only have X tomorrow. The YZ went away because it didn't potentiate. Slow wave sleep gives you growth of dendritic connections. REM sleep, you play back memories through the connections and potentiate them. So if you're not sleeping, you may lose what you think you gained today and have to do it all over again tomorrow. And you don't want to pay for twice as many sessions as you should have. Fix the sleep. And at that point, you get the learning curve.
Karen, you're in Israel, we're in the States. How is mental health looked upon? Is it a stigmatism? People don't want to admit that they have a mental health problem? It's like that here. What's it like over in Israel?
I think it's on the verge of changing. Maybe not enough, but something is going on. I think there's more and more discussion about the way we deal with mental health. Also, the way we overdiagnose and overtreat medically. I think some of the people who were previously involved in a lot of the psychiatric research, like Tom Inzo, and then kind of maybe see things a bit differently today. And there's more criticism with how we approach mental health. And I hope, I don't know, I hope because I, in the past year, I also work a lot with elderly. So there's a whole movement on how to think about this age more positively and prepare for it and take, you know, more active position to train your brain, to be active, to take care of your health, et cetera, after you retire. So I really hope that this is a general kind of perspective, that we are supposed to be more aware and knowledgeable about ourselves, about what's going on with us, you know, how certain situations in life kind of, you know, overactivate, you know, our patterns, what trigger us, and how we can get the proper response. I think with technology and startups and more open discussion because of like social media, then maybe there is a certain movement into rethinking mental health. I don't know if you feel the same movement in the US, although I read a lot of what's going on in the US, and we're highly affected by the US in Israel.
Well, I don't think you have any argument here about the DSM not being necessarily the gold standard of how to do things. We have the dumpster fire here, voodoo doll. We stick needles in the voodoo doll of the DSM all the time, you know. And you're right. Tom did a wonderful service by declaring it an invalid document before it was published, and that rocked the psychiatry world in a major way. There's been a lot of pushback. People trying to maintain the inertia of being able to operate the way they've been used to operating. But then change is very difficult for people, and that they hold on to old structures and methods. But it's falling away. The behavioral-based diagnosis is being replaced with biomarkers and phenotypes and genotypes and objective lab tests. You know, psychiatry is being held to the same kind of a standard that cardiology was held to. You know, if you're just complaining of chest pain and you did angioplasty on everybody who had a chest pain, half of them would have indigestion and not need a angioplasty. So the symptom just tells you what testing to consider. It doesn't tell you how to treat. And the symptom in psychiatry should tell them they have to do an examination of something, usually the brain or chemistry, and, you know, try and figure out what the root cause is, as opposed to what's the symptom. Symptoms are stories. People tell stories and they change. So they're not a reliable way to judge things.
if you go to a doctor's office and you get that clipboard, I'm assuming it's the same way in Israel. You have to fill out your history and whatnot. Why don't doctors be more open to, hey, could you submit for a DNA sample so you could see what the propensity is for these diseases versus taking your word for it? It's sort of like the same thing, you know, and with mental health, you know, and doing an EEG. Am I off base thinking that way? Because like when I talk to my doctor about my DNA, because when 23andMe came out, I don't know, dozen years ago, whatever, I was the first one all in, and then the FDA came in and cracked them down. But I got one for my whole family and saying, look, guys, who knows if this is going to happen, but keep an eye out for boom, 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 boom. Some members in the family didn't want to know. Others, you know, certain peoples in the population, well, hey, I don't want to know. Don't take a brain scan. I don't want to know if something's wrong upstairs. Is that what's going on?
You know, we've got all sorts of kinds of testing. Genetic testing for medication prediction largely looks at liver function and how you process the, are you a rapid metabolizer or not? And they're getting closer to actually looking at brain neurotransmitter stuff, but it's been largely a metabolic pathway. You know, I've taught EEG groups for a long time, and historically, back in the beginning, it wasn't really a whole bunch of MD PhDs in the audience. There weren't a lot of psychiatry folks in the audience. There weren't a lot of neurology folks in the audience. It was master's degree counselors and psychologists and meditators and people interested in biofeedback, neurofeedback. But about maybe 12 years ago or so, I had a psychiatrist attend one of my courses, and I ruined his career. He was a normal psychiatrist doing normal, you know, walk in the door, tell me your story, I'll prescribe you a med. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, come back. We'll try something else. You know, just a regular practice. But he got bit by the brainwave bug, and he basically changed his practice. His wife started to tell him, don't spend more money on all this crazy equipment, a TMS device for $250,000, more EEG amplifiers and databases. And finally, he got rid of his wife because he was hooked on this crazy neuroscience thing. And she was dead set against spending the money on it. But he ended up with a 2-page spread in the Washington Post talking about his practice. You could, I suppose, if you're a billionaire, pay for a 2-page spread in the Washington Post. But it changed his practice in a major way. He had people come from Australia and Europe to come to him for assessments. If you walk in the door of his practice today, there's an EEG tech in the lobby that hooks you up. They look at your EEG if he's going to change your meds. They look at your EEG if you're going to do TMS or biofeedback or neurofeedback or talk therapy. They look at your brain activity and they track it across time. So he now has a registered EEG tech doing hookups, and it's changed his practice. His psychiatry practice, he doesn't call himself a psychiatrist anymore. He calls himself a neurotherapist. And, you know, so are things changing? Things are changing in a crazy way. They're, the very ground under our feet is shifting. The high end of people that have picked up this tool are starting to change their practices. Earlier, we mentioned Tanju Sürmeli in Turkey, in Istanbul. The psychiatrists there challenged his license. He was doing EEG and QEG and neurofeedback, and they said, well, you're doing voodoo, you're not doing psychiatry, and they were trying to take his license away. We had to get people in the U.S. and in Europe and internationally to write letters of support. Societies wrote letters of support. Basically, they backed off and didn't take away his license. But, you know, things have changed since then. Now he has a television show. It's like Dr. Oz, sort of, or Dr. somebody here in the United States, I guess. Dr. Oz is a little bit more political now. But, you know, I was in London with him, and people at the airport were wanting to take pictures with him. They would recognize him as a TV star. And his practice has a waiting list. They're waiting months to get in for him. The psychiatrists who are challenging his license are now trying to figure out what it is he's doing and be able to do them also, because he's got a waiting list and they don't. So, you know, it's changing and it's working and it's expanding and it's growing. And I'm happy to see my old friend Doron Toder is now head of a psychiatry group over in Israel. We're becoming the foundational people as opposed to the outliers that aren't thinking straight, according to others. So things are changing. It's going to take time, but the change is afoot, and it's real positive.
Karen Avarami, neuroscientist, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Jay, thank you for working overtime, man. You earned your keep this week. I'm going to pay you double.
Zero times two. Oh,
zero times two. You and me both. Hey, we thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon business supporters. Mary Tracy's Neurotraining Strategies offers a higher standard of EEG, QEG education to EEG clinicians, technicians, and neurofeedback practitioners with convenient online BCAA and QEG certified didactic courses. Register now at eegstrategies.com. Hey, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. It really helps. It takes three people from learning about neurofeedback and Israel mental health to 3,000. That little click and like is a difference maker. Subscribe now. Let's turn them three people to 3,000. Hey, do you have an idea for a topic or guest? Please email Pete at neuronoodle.com or leave us a voicemail. Please give us 5 stars on Apple's podcast. And hey, if you have if it comes to you in the middle of the night, say, you know what? I like to do more for neurofeedback. We are not against you supporting us on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. We love our Patreon peeps, don't we, Jay?
Absolutely. They get awfully good coverage here for awfully little price.
Especially this show. See you.